You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. I'm recording this the week after Thanksgiving, 2023. I have spoken of the topic we're going to deal with today. I don't think I've spoken about it on this broadcast, but I've written about it back in 2015. I've put together something new in 2023. Before I do that, as always, I appeal to you. I'm independent and able to do this full-time because of my listeners, whether it be donations or Patreon or whatever it might be. You guys are the ones that keep me going, and for that, I thank you. Donating to me keeps me in one piece and keeps me completely independent. I don't have to worry about any institution giving orders. That creates a feeling. You know, very few academics can say that. That being said, though, and speaking of independence, today we're going to talk about Libya. Libya was back in the news, I think it was September, because of the flooding. We'll actually mention that here in a little bit. But I've covered so many of the governments and nations that have been subject to American sanctions and invasion, just showing the patterns over and over again. The template, ideologically and militarily, is identical. They simply fill in a new date and a new leader. They take the most corrupt elements from that society and put them up as leaders. The U.S. or the West controls elections. And all of this is done so that liberalism can't be harmed. There's a great book I recommend from Eric Ring. It's called Liberal Barbarism and the European Destruction of the Palace of the Emperor of China. He uses that example during the Opium Wars, this absolutely stunning ancient palace, that because China manifests its independence against Western drug dealers, the British East India Company and the British Navy in general, they wanted to destroy the root of that independence, which they considered to be the architecture, the art, all of the scrolls and the books that were present in that enormous palace. This is all based on free trade. But free trade comes down to radically transforming society, replacing all other forms of human interaction with the principle of so-called free exchange. And this was the ideology of the British Empire, and this is the ideology of the American, the regime, decades later. Most of China was addicted to opium because the British were so dedicated to free trade. But because that's the core of liberalism, whether it be socially, economically, or anything else, politically, the color revolutions use the same kind of rhetoric. If you go back to I think I did more than one on the Opium Wars, my broadcast there, I go through the ideological similarities in great detail. Because China constituted this huge market, which at the time was untapped by foreign commerce, this just blew them away, the profits that they were able to make. And Libya, it's really no different. Libya, of course, is much smaller, was a fairly well-off society, but oil, having a huge reserve, as well as gas and minerals. Of course, the intervention in 2011 is always couched in the modern version of civilization versus barbarism, which is democratic and authoritarian. These are code words. They don't mean what they normally do, but they're used ideologically to refer to liberal and non-liberal states, which they then call democratic or authoritarian. Of course, the regime, Western democracies, are extremely authoritarian, as only a very small sliver of differing opinion is permitted in public. Colonel Muammar Gaddafi ruled from a coup in 1969 to his absolutely sordid murder in 2011. Not only was he murdered, he was tortured to death by guerrillas that had been financed and many of them trained by either the US or the UK. All of these countries, from South Africa to Yugoslavia, or Serbia, I should say, to Egypt, to Iraq, all end up the same way. After the color revolution or the violence, either domestically or imposed from the outside, the prosperity of the previous society is destroyed, and the society is pushed back into the third world. Since the 2011 murder, Libya has been plunged. Since then, more than a decade of violence, guerrilla warfare, chaos, and of course, oligarchy. Since now, the Western corporations, who Gaddafi was able to keep at bay, have bought up everything that could possibly be protected. I've said this before, but the economy of these countries is far more of a threat to liberal or Israeli interests than its military apparatus. In fact, Gaddafi didn't have much of a military apparatus. It was highly modern, but relatively small. So these revolutions, whether physical or just a color revolution, these are not short-term policies. This is about taking a country on the cusp of the first world and shoving them down back to the third world again, where they belong. Well, in the place of Gaddafi, you have the major oil companies. The U.S. financed the protests in October of 2011. Really no different than the Syrian case. The pro-Gaddafi protesters were far larger than the anti. If you do a Google image search for the protest signs, they're almost all in English from the opposite side. With all the typical media slogans scrawled on it, and either the tribesmen or the peasants or the workers holding these signs couldn't read them. Their life depended on it. So once Gaddafi fell and was murdered, the country fell to pieces. It was one of Africa, it's probably Africa's only success story after the fall of South Africa. Today, you have two general ones, but lots of more specific ones, armed groups that have taken over parts of the country. The truth is, Gaddafi presided over a prosperous nation. He was seen as a model for African development after decades of false starts. But it was his very success. It was the prosperity of Libya. Now, when he took power in that coup, it took a few years to consolidate. But of course, oil is the main resource. His takeover in 1969 led in the early 70s to a revolution. This is a social nationalist revolution in every way. In fact, we'll talk about his ideology here in a little bit. Oil was taken out of the hands of the Western oil companies and plowed into domestic investment. This approach rapidly developed. This economy, prior to that, had been very impoverished. This is about economic sovereignty, which is a key element to nationalism and social nationalism. In fact, he fully nationalized the Western Oil Company in the creation of his National Oil Corporation. This was the body that redirected oil profits inward, rather to the oligarchy outside of the country. But how can you have an independent country if your main strategic resource is controlled by others, especially hostile others? But Gaddafi was as pure a social nationalist as you could find in the day-to-day, the dirty politics of the 20th and 21st centuries. Whether it be in education or housing or public works, basic necessities, you had subsidies that come from the oil wealth and saw radical improvements in living conditions. In 1969, Libya was one of the poorest countries in Africa, which is saying something. But in 2011, it was the continent's leader, according to the UN Human Development Index. The UN Development Program, published in 2010, considered Libya a high development country, that is to say, a first world country. In 2015, here's what I wrote in my article, which I don't know where it is. I think it's on Patreon. I can't remember now. Gaddafi was a threat because he showed a different way of successful development without U.S. assistance. The domestic success of Gaddafi's government showed him as a social nationalist leader who used his substantial executive power to plow oil revenues back into Libyan development. He did so without creating excessive inequality and without recourse to Marxist or communist slogans. He was a clear nationalist and used oil wealth for Libyans, not outsiders, and he was doomed because of this sin against free trade. Gaddafi had a target on his back, not just because of his domestic policy, but his foreign policy too. He was building ties with Russia and Turkey. He was connected closely with Venezuela and Cuba. But at the time of Gaddafi's murder, Libya had the highest GDP per capita and also the highest life expectancy on the African continent. Fewer people lived below the poverty line in Libya than did the Netherlands. Protests erupted suspiciously in Tunisia, in the capital city, in December of 2010, and slowly seeped over the border into Libya. Now, I don't know enough about Tunisia to make a lot of comments, but the agenda certainly was vague. Corruption, no standards of public behavior, stuff like that. But like most color revolutions, and especially in this case, the Libyan version, there was no mass foundation. The closest they could get is Islamic groups in the pay of Washington. Gaddafi was genuinely popular. But the Islamic movement in Benghazi led to the passing of Resolution 1973 from the UN, and that's when the bombing campaign began. This enormous threat to liberal interests would be neutralized once Gaddafi and his loyalists were removed from power. So this isn't just a change in sovereign. This is a complete revolutionary transformation of the country. The Libyan civil war, the American intervention was based on media lies. They invented every conceivable. He supposedly had a sex dungeon. He was a multi-trillionaire. He slaughtered civilians for no reason. He had any number of dungeons. Just go through the literature here, at least on the web. And one of the things that they used to get this resolution passed was that the Libyan army was killing civilians, which doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So, Resolution 1973, the French foreign minister, Diouppé, asserted in a speech to the Security Council that as Gaddafi's forces retook certain cities, he started slaughtering people, his opponents. He said, unless we act now, we have very little time left. Now, of course, I at the time, and then in subsequent analysis says, that there was no such policy. There were no mass civilian casualties, because that policy would assume he's not popular. Any kind of massacre in Benghazi, there was nothing like that. The rebels had been driven out in early 2011 without very much civilian damage whatsoever. The concept of the appalling human rights abuses over 40 years was entirely invented. Because when the regime faces non-liberal governments, the sky's the limit. Radical Islam motivated those revolutionaries on the payroll of the CIA, despite the fact that Islam was the official religion under Gaddafi, but he only wanted to use domestic sources of, not clergy, they don't have clergy, but, you know, the structure of the Islamic movement. In March of 2011, Gaddafi said, "All the rebels who lay down your arms will be completely amnestied." City after city, no civilians were harmed. And it makes sense, given that this is a popular government that maintained economic sovereignty. Gaddafi wanted to negotiate with protesters. He said, "If you just come back over, I will increase the development assistance that your area will get." The army was the absolute last resort. And because they refused to negotiate, because they refused to talk, that's a strong piece of evidence that they were under direct Western influence. But even Amnesty International, you know I'm no fan of groups like that, they said that the human rights violations were a fantasy during the war, because these protests eventually led to armed clashes, with weapons coming from the West, of course. They did notice that the rebels in Benghazi did make false claims, and they manufactured evidence under Western influence. And, of course, the Western press immediately repeated these without criticism, without comment. No one called the Libyan embassy. No one spoke to figures in government. They just took whatever the CIA gave them. They were pretending that protesters were peaceful. This disgraceful media coverage, despite the fact that they were showing them carrying weaponry. U.S. intelligence invented stories that the rebels could use, and the media rubber stamp went along. There was no intelligence in Gaddafi at the time that could be trusted. But siding with Islamic militants is nothing new. The West has been financing them for years, from Chechnya to Bosnia, Macedonia, Syria, Iraq, and now Libya, just to name a few. Militant Islam was a key element in this revolt. Again, Syria is the exact same thing. Gaddafi came out and said Al-Qaeda is headquartered in Benghazi, suggesting that the fact that the U.S. was financing this group, that they were never enemies in the first place. Their role in 9/11 is probably a work of fiction, because if that was actually true, they wouldn't be subsidizing them 10 years later. But Gaddafi was a little bit naive if he thought that the Western world didn't know that. He was on the verge of taking Benghazi because it was the headquarters of the Islamic militant movement. And NATO warplanes protected those groups, clearly displaying what side they were on. The exact same thing happened in Syria with ISIS. No one denied that Al-Qaeda was the centerpiece of this revolt in that part of Libya. The West was more than aware of that. And one of the places that you can go for information is a parliamentary report from the House of Commons, specifically the Foreign Relations Committee in the UK. And when they're talking about, and this report is extremely valuable, the French led the way in Libya. And they had a specific, you know, that was their, you know, part of the world at one point. And let me quote from this report, trying to figure, you know, what's the real motive for intervention? Well, this is incomplete. I'll quote them. And this is from the parliamentary report directly. "A further insight into French motivations was provided in a Freedom of Information disclosure by the United States State Department in December 2015. In April of 2011, Sidney Blumenthal, advisor and unofficial intelligence analyst to then United States Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, reported this conversation with French intelligence officers to the Secretary of State. And according to these conversations, these individuals, Sarkozy's plans, he was president at the time, were driven by the following issues, and they list five. A desire to gain a greater share of Libya oil production, to increase French influence in North Africa, to improve the internal political situation in France, provide the French military with an opportunity to reassert its position in the world, and five, to address the concern of his advisors over Gaddafi's long-term plans to supplant France as a dominant power in Francophone Africa. Now, all of that is true, but there were other issues, protecting Israeli interests, destroying a national socialist state that was a model of development. The fact that Gaddafi offered to hand over power and just step down, and the West says no, suggests that there's a lot more going on here. The West demanded war. The economy had to be destroyed, and the small but modern army loyal to Gaddafi had to be neutralized. So by the summer of 2011, the limited intervention, the so-called protect civilians, and no one really bought that except for media, had fallen over into regime change. Regime change is more than just an alteration in who is president of a country. Regime change is another word for revolution. In fact, there's a very good reason to believe that Gaddafi was trying to flee the country when he was murdered. In fact, he was headed, the same parliamentary report said the same thing, that he was headed to exile in Venezuela. After telephone calls from this is where they tracked him down, was through his phone. They could have had a negotiated solution. But there was no evidence whatsoever that the Prime Minister David Cameron at the time wanted to use the well-known contacts that both London and Paris had with the Islamic groups in Libya. In other words, they focused exclusively on military intervention. They could have easily had Gaddafi's resignation. No, this wasn't just a transfer of power. And it also suggests that the government was legitimately popular. So the entire thing had to be uprooted. We saw the same thing in Iraq, and there was an attempt to do that in Syria and Sudan. Now, the same House of Commons report speaks in depth of how this intervention wrecked the economy, according to plan, of course. In 2010, the Libyan economy generated some $75 billion in gross domestic product. That comes down to an average annual per capita income of $12,250, which is more or less the European average. Libyan revenue greatly exceeded expenditure in the 2000s. They constantly had a trade surplus. And again, I mentioned the United Nations Human Development Report. The aggregate measure of health, education, income ranked Libya as the 53rd most advanced country in the world for human development and as the most advanced country in Africa. Now, what happened? The last year you can have reliable figures, I think, is 2014. The average annual income for Libyans was that from that initial figure, $12,250, in 2010 to about $7,000 in 2014. There was no economic performance at all. This huge trade surplus now has led to a deficit that now amounts to well over 100% of GDP. So financing that debt, which goes straight through the Western banks, took all of the Libyan foreign reserves. Those reserves went from $107 billion in 2013 to negative numbers just a few years later. It didn't help that in the second half of 2014, the oil price went down. And of course, at the same time, inflation is going up. There was a 14% increase of food prices a year after Gaddafi's death in 2012. So it went from whatever it is, the 50th most advanced, to now the 94th most advanced country in the 2015 Index of Human Development. And there's no end in sight there. I want to quote from Gadikai Chingu in 2014. This is what he wrote in the Center for Research on Globalization. For over 4 years, Gaddafi promoted economic democracy and used a nationalized oil wealth to sustain progressive social welfare programs for all Libyans. Under Gaddafi's rule, Libyans enjoyed not only free health care and free education, but free electricity and interest-free loans. Now, thanks to NATO's intervention, the healthcare sector is on the verge of collapse. Thousands of Filipino healthcare workers flee the country. Institutions of higher education across the east of the country are shut down, and blackouts are a common occurrence in the once thriving capital city of Tripoli. But given what Gaddafi did, what would a quote-unquote elected government have done differently? The successes of Gaddafi could never occur under the IMF-imposed structural reforms. The central bank, I don't have to tell you, is owned by the state, did not take interest and did not, or certainly didn't take interest as profit. 1970, literacy in Libya was about 25%. At the time of his murder, the whole country was literate. Any citizen who wanted to start a farm was offered free land and implements, livestock and housing. Education, medical treatment, all that was free. So what would a liberal government have done differently, other than dismantling all this? Newlyweds were given a grant of $50,000. Any purchase of a car subsidized at 50% of the purchase price, still with zero debt and a massive trade surplus. This was a model for the third world, and that's precisely why Gaddafi had to go. You have assets now sold after 2011, 2012, 2013, under the democratic system, which of course never went anywhere. Assets were sold off at pennies in the dollar to conglomerates. All oil has been diverted by Western companies. Of course, Libya has plunged into debt, disease, civil war. Libya now is a third world state and a vassal to NATO. Now, briefly, as briefly as I can, I want to talk about his ideology. I've never discussed his Green Book before, put together over a period of time in the 1970s. Because, of course, I'm saying that Libya was a social nationalist state, ideology was a motive for, I mean, he was flexible, but ideology was a motive force for him. It's a way to situate the philosophical threat that he offered to the West. And it's divided into three parts. Some people call his Green Book the Third International Theory. And the first part, from 1976, is a rejection of Western concepts of democracy. It comes to, you know, political parties or anything like that. He wanted to build something along the lines of the worker boards of Tito's Yugoslavia. These ground-up people's congresses and people's committees. But the book says that, and we all know this, that parliamentarism, liberal democracy in the political realm, simply is the rule of the few. Whoever wins in the electoral charade, the only people who win are the parties or the classes, not the nation as a whole. It could never lead to actual representative government. The political struggle leads to the rise of an oligarchy, a minority, as he says, and through perfectly legal means. Genuine democracy, of course, can't be done through these periodic elections. A parliament could never, in Gaddafi's point of view, speak for the nation. It can't be people who speak on the nation's behalf. It has to be the nation as such. How much money is needed to run a campaign? The politicians who need elite money to get elected then have to manipulate the population, and somehow they're able to speak in their name. Parliament represents the groups that finance politicians. It's a fraudulent system. Votes are always bought and manipulated. It's a fraud. He calls it the concept of liberal democracy is an outdated practice. The second part has a lot to do, this is a few years later, is the economic part. He rejects the very concept of a wage. That if a worker produces a product under any condition, the worker has a right to that product. Every Libyan adult should be working according to his abilities and able to satisfy basic needs, but any surplus beyond that doesn't go to a plutocracy, but to the accumulation of what he called social wealth. The accumulation of a surplus from one person means that it's lessened elsewhere. And very much like the Yugoslavian case, this is actually 77-78, the concept is self-government in the economy. If there's no democracy there, in the normal sense of the word, then there certainly can't be in politics. Like Yugoslavia, enterprises were to be ruled by a board of the employees, essentially a collective management system. It was very tough to implement, just like in Yugoslavia, but that was a distinct attempt. A lot of people don't realize that in that part of the Green Book, anyone living in a house or an apartment was, just by that fact, an owner, not a tenant, not someone just paying rent. So in 1978, the concept of rent, in the sense of paying rent to live someplace, was outlawed. Rent was abolished. For him, this was the creation of a new socialist society, or in this case, a national socialist society. The third part is a bit more chaotic. He talks about everything from education to sports to globalization. But it's, you know, philosophically, it's very interesting. He sees society as this social chain. The family, meaning the extended family, then from that, the clan, the tribe, the nation, then, of course, the world, from the smallest self-sufficient entity to the greatest. These nesting communities, this is the core of true representation. Gaddafi says, a tribe is the same as a family, but one that has increased due to the increased growth of offspring. That is, a tribe is a big family. The nation is a tribe, but a tribe that has grown as a result of increased offspring. That is, a nation is one large tribe. And the same thing goes for the world. Nationalism is the central conception. It's related to, but distinct from, things like religions or empire. And he goes so far as to say that the reason that an empire might fall is because it loses the ability to represent the real nations under its sway. For him, the tribe, or the very extended family, is in, remember, Libya then and now is a very tribal society, something that Gaddafi tried to break, but this was the most self-sufficient entity on a small scale for basic needs. This is accepted social tradition at the time. The clan would, you know, they would act in surety for each other. But, of course, they're too small in and of themselves. So, ultimately, the Green Book was the foundation of policy. It was written and put together at the same time Gaddafi was putting this system together. But it's really one long critique of what we call liberalism. There's a there was an article published a few months ago, and it cites the former Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates. In 2014, he wrote an autobiography called Duty, Memoirs of a Secretary at War. And he says things in there that I've been saying for a long time, and I can't believe how blatantly he says it. He says, for example, that when war was decided upon in 2001, Afghanistan, he admits and says that there was nobody in Washington that had any real functional knowledge of the area. In other words, the various ethnic groups, rivalries, ideologies, or Islam as a whole, was a total mystery. to elites in Washington. Now, that's almost word for word what I wrote in 2016 in my book, The Foreign Policy of Mass Society, The Failure of Western Engagement in the Islamic World. And I'm quoting him here. He says, "Nearly always, we begin military engagements profoundly ignorant about our adversaries and about the situation on the ground." Gates admits further that in the Bush administration, the second Bush administration, he was clueless about the economic conditions of Iraq in 2003. Iraq, yet another growing economy, reduced to third world status after not only crushing sanctions, but the destruction of the infrastructure mostly from the air. Strangling economic potential, that was the goal. But it doesn't matter. Ignorance is apparently bliss. Tribalism is both a positive and a negative in Libyan society, though. Social nationalism requires that these tribes have a specific place, but don't go beyond that specific place. You can't just come to power and demand that the tribes give way. But to the extent that they're very strong, they will always threaten the unity of any government in the country. Gaddafi himself came from within the semi-nomadic Bedouin tribe in North Libya, and his authority on these things was absolutely second to none. What he did when he took over was he divided Libya into sections, simple square regions drawn deliberately to divide the boundaries from tribe to tribe. And it was a success. Years later, of course, the U.S. and France did everything they could to not just rebuild these tribal loyalties, but then infuse them with Islamic radicalism. You had these heavily armed protesters starting in late 2010, the media consistently calling them spontaneous protests that came due to the illegitimacy of the government. But the CIA knew better. They knew that the opposition was actually pretty small. So a direct assault by foreign powers was necessary. In fact, a group of commandos from the Netherlands, their SEAL team, KCT, were taken prisoner by Gaddafi's forces. I mean, they were enemy combatants without question in 2011. They had been dropped off from the air. And then on February 24th of that same year, the HMS Cumberland came to Benghazi, which is Libya's second largest city. And that's where the SAS stepped onto Libyan soil as opponents. And that's, you know, a few weeks later is when the bombing began. And needless to say, they were targeting civilian economic structures far more than military ones. You also don't need to hear that this so-called revolt has been planned, especially in Paris, since at least the summer or fall of 2010. There was a guy, Nuri al-Mismari, who his title was the chief of protocol. He fell out of favor with Gaddafi, and he ended up moving to France. So as this develops, 2009, 2010, he was approached by the French authorities. He explained the situation in Libya, I'm sure, you know, totally unbiased, and he met with French military officers. Now, a lot of what he said simply wasn't true, but they also brought in, this is late 2010, three Libyan insurgents, Mansouri, Charant, and Bokris, were in Paris, and they were trained as the point men for the rebel armies. So this entire uprising was created in just a few weeks in late 2010. There was no organic opposition movement. I'm not sure what they would do better than what Gaddafi had already done. Of course, Sarkozy, ruling until 2012, was president of France. Just like all these other guys, projecting their own failures onto this Libyan foreigner. But he was incensed because a year earlier, 2009, the French, very dominant energy firm called Total, was forced to accept lower profits. They had to sign the contract with the National Oil Corporation. Now, these guys aren't used to hearing the word no. They didn't have a lot of experience dealing with a legitimate nationalist, but they had to accept lower terms. 30% from Libya's gas production rate, but they had taken half before. The difference, of course, always invested in the country rather than going to the hands of foreigners. And that really was probably the last straw for the regime. And the same thing happened to Chevron and Occidental Petroleum. But it's a dangerous game. See, it's not just that Libya has the highest, the greatest oil reserves in Africa, but the highest quality, probably available worldwide. The British had almost £2 billion invested in Libya. And the British Minister of Trade and Investment, Lord Stephen Green, who went to Tripoli in 2011, and he was there in the capacity, of course, as Minister of Trade, but he was there with businessmen, people from British Petroleum and Shell, and they helped create the National Transitional Council, the soon-to-be government of Libya, that they, in fact, had put together. Here's what The Guardian said. This is September 26, 2011. British companies are not alone in seeking to make money in post-Gaddafi Libya. The best hotels in Tripoli and Benghazi are bustling with visiting businessmen as well as security consultants, diplomats, and journalists. Clearly, this was an economic move. The fact that journalists are included with these other people is funny, because their sole purpose is to rationalize and justify the oligarchy's takeover of the country. So there was no doubt at this point that the nationalist policies of Gaddafi were the cause of his attack. And of course, to monopolize the oil wealth of the place. Early 2011, Sarkozy demanded that Mr. Gaddafi must leave, as if he's, you know, firing an employee. Then, a month later, this is what Obama said. Mr. Gaddafi has lost legitimacy and needs to leave. And a whole bunch of elites, head of the European Commission, all that. Classic projection. Everything, and I mean everything, that they accused Gaddafi of, they themselves suffered from. Talk about a crisis of legitimacy. The fact is that Gaddafi did everything right and nothing wrong, but that's the problem. There were no real details given. The only legitimate power in the country was Gaddafi, as been proven since 2011. As of today, no one has taken his place. No institution, no constitution, no politician. Obama has had his legitimacy questioned from day one, making the airhead, Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State, of course, was a sick joke. She was just a spokesman for elite industries, not a real Secretary of State in the normal sense of the term. But WikiLeaks also proved that she was simply the spokesman for oil firms, etc. The White House in February of 2011, they just repeated the same slogans. The brutalization of its people. They accused Gaddafi. Angela Merkel said the same thing. She said the same thing about Libya and the second war in Iraq. But I used the projection, the psychology of projection, because they're condemning Gaddafi for what they knew they were doing at the same time. They were actually brutalizing areas of the country where these Islamic militants had no support. But they were able to convince the United Nations to impose a no-fly zone over these nonsensical human rights abuses coming from the highly politicized intelligence agencies. In June of that year, Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, who was the son of Muammar, said that one of Libya's major errors was to delay the purchase of weaponry from Russia. At the time, prior to the war, Gaddafi was engaged in liberalization. But of course, that never works. An Indian historian, Vijay Prashad, said, again, another critical mistake, is similar to what Saif said, the critical mistake was to give up any attempt at building a nuclear weapon. But nuclear weapons were not even part of the equation. Nuclear power was. And I'm saying that whether you are Israel, the U.S., France, the diversification of your energy base is far more threatening than a nuclear weapon. Gaddafi completely abandoned, as a goodwill gesture, to stop enriching uranium. For power, not for nuclear weapons. Gaddafi didn't see the larger picture. He was warned. Delegations from Iran and North Korea said, you can't be doing this. You can't try to be friendly with the West. They take all of this as a sign of weakness. They will stop at nothing to destroy you. That ignoramus John Bolton said years earlier, the April 2003 attack in Iraq, that anyone pursuing nuclear weapons, consider this a message. Now, I've said it before, I'll say it again. Nuclear power is created by a completely different chemical process, a completely different plant, a completely different set of specialists than weapons grade. And you can't easily transfer one to another. So any mention of nuclear weapons, this is for, I mean, unlike Israel, who of course doesn't have it, Israel has biological weapons too, is simply for public consumption. Iraq, of course, never had nuclear or biological weapons, unlike Israel, and neither did Libya. The attack on Iraq in 2003, or the second Iraq war, they had to soften the country up. So worried was the U.S. about the ability of Iraq to mount resistance that they needed to destroy the country in advance of an invasion. It's kind of like a boxer having his bodyguards beat up an opponent before a fight. So many of the countries targeted by invasion, civil war, color revolutions were successful states. The pattern of disinformation identical in each case. Anyway, at the time, more than 10 enrichment facilities were dismantled. He did have biological weapons, which he destroyed. The Americans only said they destroyed it. You remember my talk on the settlement movement in Israel. Israel has been using chemical weapons, biological agents, on its enemies since the 40s. Places like ExxonMobil, Chevron, British Petroleum helped set up the U.S.-Libya Business Association during Gaddafi's liberalization drive, which started around then. There was a utter contempt of the regime against Gaddafi's Libyan National Oil Corporation. In fact, Obama seized about $30 billion in cash, and any account under American legal sovereignty was stolen. Now, according to the IMF, under Obama, Gaddafi had 143.8 tons of gold, which at the time was worth about $7 billion, in international reserves in 25 countries. That's how it was spread around. That is exactly 143.8 tons more than the U.S. owned. All of it was either frozen or simply stolen by the Americans. Libya had invested its sovereign wealth funds abroad. You know, it's an oil exporting country. All of this was stolen. So what they did in the Russian case is nothing new. Unlike NATO, Gaddafi was not a threat to anybody. At least not in the normal sense of the term. Didn't even have a large army. The other thing that Saif said is not just building up the army and going to, not going to the Russians, but delaying even further modernization of the army that existed. Now, when the rebels first took action in Benghazi in early 2011, you had British and French special forces using some of these insurgents to capture the oil refineries, which are overwhelmingly located in the north and east of the country. And this is where the brutal battles were fought. Retaining control over Libya's oil, using proxy fighters again, this was the point here. But even before the shooting started, you had special forces from the U.S., Britain, and France on Libyan soil. You know, MI6, Navy SEALs, SAS, CIA advisors, French secret agents. But that's what his liberalization scheme got him. When it comes to dealing with oil firms, Chevron, Occidental Petroleum, their cuts were a matter of secrecy in 2009. You had to go to WikiLeaks to see exactly You know, I mentioned how their profit margin and their entitlement were scaled back substantially. They considered this outrageous. The West portion of gas production was reduced to 30% of the whole. They were used to 50%, as I mentioned before. But the British ambassador at the time, Frank Baker, said in 2018 that the war that they were planning, or that they planned, was, quote, helping to create a more permissible environment for trade and investment and to uncover opportunities for British expertise to help Libya's reconstruction. By the end of 2011, Libya was a shadow of its former self. And I said by 2015, Libya was the 94th most advanced country. 4 years later, at the end of 2019, it was 105th and dropping. 50 places fallen in less than a decade. Massive decline in living standards, which is entirely based on this so-called humanitarian intervention. Let me repeat myself here. Libya under Gaddafi had a higher per capita GDP than the European Union, and about the same as the United States. But how do these facts, what do they do to the Western democracy narrative? Huge amount of money. And the U.S. wanted to use NATO as almost a way to outsource the war so the Americans can say that we're just one of a coalition. They use this rhetoric once in a while. The U.S. was spending $10 million a day to sustain this operation. War crimes were committed constantly. Gaddafi never did it, but the U.S. did do it. Massacre of civilian populations in Sirte, in northern Libya. NATO warplanes destroyed the entire infrastructure of the city. So by the end of the invasion, let's say fall of 2011, Sirte was in ruins. No one was living there at the time. Aircraft from Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, were flying over Libya. They were a part of the assault team. So did Sweden. And the Jordanians. The Italians. Despite the fact that Italy is the largest trading partner of Libya. Of course, not anymore. The Qatari Special Forces were a huge part of this. There were hundreds in every region, or so says the chief of staff of the Qatari Armed Forces, Major General Hamad Atiya. And in fact, the Qatari Special Forces, that was the link between the anti-Qaddafi guerrillas on the one hand and NATO on the other. The New York Times saw an April 2011 article, or really a letter, signed by Obama, Sarkozy, and David Cameron. And it's humorous. One of the quotes is, "Our duty and our mandate under the UN Security Council Resolution 1973 is to protect civilians, and we are doing that. It is not to remove Gaddafi by force, but it is impossible to imagine a future for Libya without Gaddafi in power." Of course, it's double talk, it's nonsense. Civilians were not in danger. They were aware of that. The only civilians that were in danger was when they went in there. And the Americans and the British went in there. The whole thing was designed as a deception. And it was written at a third grade level by some hack somewhere. The U.S. was using these jihadists all over Europe and Central Asia and the Middle East and simply just sent them again to fight Gaddafi. In 2011, very early, or very late 2010, you had a lot of Libyan Islamic militants who'd been freed by Gaddafi as another goodwill gesture that was taken as by the regime as a form of weakness. Gaddafi, he doesn't have much excuse here. He was one of the few leaders to actually delineate what the problem was in 1999 with the invasion of Yugoslavia. When the missiles rained down on Niš, Serbia's, I think, the third largest city, hundreds of precision-guided missiles, 2% of them, landed on military installations. They used cluster bombs. the NATO list of civilian targets was codenamed Stage 3, specifically in Kosovo. While it was published on the internet, someone leaked it. It was ignored entirely by the press. No, it was about destroying the civilian infrastructure. They're not even dual use. Everything from hospitals and schools to museums and most certainly churches. The Canadian ambassador to Yugoslavia, James Bissell, he said it was common knowledge that NATO then went to Stage 3, civilian targets. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been bombing bridges on a Sunday afternoon in marketplaces. So what Israel does in Gaza is certainly nothing new. And we all know what happened in Yugoslavia. It's one and the same. There was briefly an attempt to have a color revolution against Netanyahu, but that's certainly not going to happen now. Milosevic, Gaddafi, they had a lot in common. They simply wouldn't obey Washington's orders. That was the decisive impulse behind the invasion of Yugoslavia, the war in Syria, and of course, Libya in 2011. So, all of that being said, what does it look like today? Well, it's really no different than in any other country targeted by the U.S. There is no legitimacy there. The CIA director, William Burns, met with the Libyan Prime Minister, Abdul Dabiba, in Tripoli. Now, of course, Dabiba is a multimillionaire, educated at the University of Toronto. And he tried to put together a government in 2021 for the sake of holding elections under the Western-appointed Libyan Political Dialogue Forum, because apparently Libyans can't be trusted with such a task. But he failed completely, and he was eventually disgraced due to blatant corruption. So you had a group of envoys, U.S., France, Germany, Italy, the U.K., meeting in Washington under Richard Norlin, the very hackish envoy to Libya from the U.S., setting election deadlines. They were staging elections. The election was going to be completely fraudulent. And now, of course, the West is very upset with the same people who they financed. Of course, elections were meant to be rigged. The country is deeply divided. Libya was incapable of recovering politically, socially, or economically. Now, the Dabiba movement is, quote-unquote, recognized by the UN, like that makes any difference, which has strong Islamic elements to it. And then their opposition is in Tobruk, which seems to be pro-Russian and pro-Turkish in the east, which is headed by Fathi Bashagha, prime minister of the so-called Government of National Stability. So you have one which is UN-based, the other one which is parliamentary-based, two governments, completely corrupt beyond belief. But most of the money actually lay in the east. Yeah, there's been a ceasefire of a sort, but there's no solution to the stalemate. The two sides have made a little bit of progress, but there's no deadline for any kind of an election. The Eastern Army is run by a General Haftar, who, by the way, is an American citizen who lived in Falls Church or Vienna, Virginia, near Langley for 2 decades. And you have, you know, so-called Muslim Brotherhood. Muslim Brotherhood is like Al-Qaeda. It's a umbrella term. They have connections themselves with Qatar and Turkey. But they can't even agree to hold elections. But the point is, they failed miserably to create even a subservient neocolonial arrangement there. Absolute failure to form any kind of unified administration. But both are dysfunctional. The Tripoli one, the Tobruk one, the Government of National Unity in Tripoli and the House of Representatives in Tobruk, which, by the way, was set on fire during a protest last year. And you have mass demonstrations and violence spreading throughout the country all the time. That's almost become institutionalized since 2011. And when the floods came in September of this year, the country was completely defenseless. The reason that the dams gave way is that no one was taking responsibility for them. And there was no money, even if there were. Anti-Gaddafi militias contained elements of the Western finance movements, whether it be ISIL or Al-Qaeda. The former CIA agent, Bob Baer, the CIA was in Libya seeing who can be armed and financed. The Islamic guerrillas were armed, and they, as always, the U.S. supported and defends both ISIL and Al-Qaeda. There's a book out by John Rossomondo called The Arab Spring Ruse, How the Muslim Brotherhood Duped Washington and Libya and Syria. Well, of course, I was saying the same things at the time. Muslim Brotherhood, again, is an imprecise label, but I think I know what he means. But duped Washington? No, Washington was well aware that it was financing these groups. The fraudulent 2011 Arab Spring. But Muslim Brotherhood was engaged. It was a whole new paradigm. Well, of course, not really, since the U.S. was doing this in Bosnia in the 90s. There was no, transformation of Iraq's Al-Qaeda to ISIS. All of that was set in motion by the U.S. and Israel and financed by it. There's no other explanation for where these huge organizations can come from with no one noticing. About the only legitimacy you have is Gaddafi's son. All the facts that we know about the economic situation in Libya means that that family was very popular. And now that goes double because now they know what happens when the regime takes over. But the U.S. is not going to permit him run. These elections are rigged because only certain parties and individuals are allowed to run for office. But if they can't agree on a time for holding elections, what are they going to do afterwards? It's no different than the older Afghan government. Western-educated, complete kleptocrats. They're stealing what little public money is available for their own benefit. There is nothing left. I think Stephanie Williams calls it a redistributive kleptocracy. The new group that the U.S. and France has installed in power on both sides of that Libyan divide. There is no recovery. There's no foundation for a recovery. None of these people or parties has any legitimacy. It's not only that people like Obama were wrong. They were saying the exact opposite of reality. CIA Director Burns tried to connect with both sides of that divide. But corruption is now just day to day. It's no different than Afghanistan a few years ago. Haftar, the general, still has a presence. Again, he's an American, speaks English. But no one individual or faction has any kind of legitimacy. What Gaddafi said in the Green Book about the nature of politics is proven true here. It is an absolute disaster. As it was Peter Bancroft Hinchy said in 2019, how NATO destroyed the tremendous social victories of Gaddafi. Civilian infrastructure, they bombed the water supply. Then they bombed the factory producing the tubes so it couldn't be repaired. Then they destroyed the electric grid. They murdered Gaddafi's great grandchildren because they were classified as legitimate targets. They murdered civilians, told lie after lie after lie after lie about the government forces that were attacking indiscriminately, when all that they were doing was trying to stem the onslaught of Western finance foreign terrorists shipped in to do NATO's dirty work. Talk about a breach of the UNSC resolutions. I've used the word genocide twice, the first in Gaza and the second here, because you have a direct assault on the ability of people to exist. They picked out civilian targets. But because it was done to protect Israel and to destroy a fascist, it's considered praiseworthy. And Gaddafi, despite his record, has very few defenders in the West. So that is the situation in Libya, and it's absolutely heartbreaking. This is what the regime is. This is what they'll do. You know, Libya today, our backyards tomorrow. Thank you, everyone, for supporting me. Thank you again for listening. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.